here with what it says in this morning's papers is Clodagh Walsh.
Four of the papers lead with the news that the remains of a man found in a burning car in Lucan in County Dublin on Monday night may have been shot previously. The Irish Daily Star, The Mirror, The Sun and The Herald all report that his remains were so badly burned, DNA testing will be required to identify him. Gardaí believe he may be a criminal from County Dublin reported missing. And the fallout from comments made by Fine Gael's by-election candidate in Wexford, Verona Murphy, still continues to make headlines. Fine Gael has been branded a safe house for right-wing politicians after the Taoiseach continued to back by-election candidate Verona Murphy, who claimed asylum seekers need to be deprogrammed when they come here, says the Irish Examiner in its main story. That echoed in the lead in the Irish Independent, which says the Taoiseach is backing Ms Murphy despite coming under pressure from some in his own party to abandon Verona Murphy's candidacy. Matt Cooper, in his column in the Irish Daily Mail, writes that the Taoiseach's reaction to Ms Murphy's comments on immigration smack of cynicism. Gerard Howland in the Examiner, meanwhile, says when the language of politics fails, it speaks for the meanest impulse. He writes in his opinion piece, our public conversation is trending down. Words matter and this must be addressed. As the matter of insurance fraud was when the Chief Justice, Mr Frank Clark, confirmed at a conference in Dublin yesterday that a panel of judges has been appointed to draft new guidelines to look at the level of compensation payouts in insurance claims. The main story in the Irish Times reports that at the same conference, the head of claims at the state's largest public sector insurer said that courts must not only throw out fabricated and inflated claims but impose costs and send fraudsters to prison. And elsewhere on its front page, a report which says that the state faces legal and other costs estimated at up to €4 million following the settlement of a case taken by Aoife Bennett of Naas, County Kildare, who developed narcolepsy after being administered with a swine flu vaccine. There's much coverage of this story in all the papers, as there is of the first live televised leaders' debate in the British general election, and the general consensus seems to be that neither the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson or Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn came out on top. And Michelle Murphy, writing in The Star, says that with the Brexit deadline just over 2 months away, it is time for the government here to look at how it can support households from the impact of Brexit. She says the lack of focus of the impact that Brexit will have on the living costs of low-income households is worrying. Worrying too is the news that most parents of young children are overweight or obese. That, says The Independent, is according to a new study on the health of the nation to be published by the Department of Health today. And the sale by RTE of some of its paintings provides the front page lead story for the Irish Daily Mail. It says the controversial decision to sell off the works of art, including two pieces by Louis Labrocki, backfired yesterday as the paintings failed to sell for the prices expected, and some of the paintings that went on sale in London had to be withdrawn. And finally, staying with that paper, it says concerns are being raised after 110 new cases of mumps were reported last week, with the biggest rise among teenagers and young adults. And the HSE has warned young people with mumps to stay away from school or college for at least 5 days to prevent the infection spreading. And it says the best protection is to be age-appropriately vaccinated with the MMR vaccine.
RTE Investigates has learned that a number of senior members of a new management team put in place at Hide and Seek Childcare following an RTE investigation into care standards at the Dublin Crest chain have resigned their position in recent days. The developments come following a decision by the High Court last week to grant an injunction pending arbitration, restraining the company's insurer from cancelling the insurance policies for its four facilities. For more on this, we're joined in studio now by Aoife Hegarty of RTE Investigates. Aoife, viewers will remember the shocking revelations in that investigation broadcast in July of this year, ranging from fire safety concerns to serious breaches of childcare regulations. But some changes were initiated by the Hide and Seek Company in the wake of the programme in an attempt to address those concerns. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, in the weeks after our programme, Hide and Seek owners did write to parents informing them of an action plan that was designed to take the company into the future. Now, that plan included the appointment of external experts. It promised the appointment of new staff and management, the implementation of a company-wide restructuring programme, and a complete audit of the company's four creche facilities was to be carried out, with any identified findings and improvements to be implemented in full. Now, that letter was written by company owner Siobhan Davy, and we've seen a copy of that letter. In the letter, she says she hoped the steps being put in place would develop a culture of communication and transparency and would begin to restore the trust parents had in their services and would return Hide and Seek to an exemplar in the field. Now, in further correspondence with parents, which we've also seen, Hide and Seek said it had recruited a new group operations manager and a second senior staff member to the role of Glasnevin creche manager. Now, you'll remember Glasnevin is a new purpose-built facility which opened on Dublin's north side in January 2018. As we revealed in the programme, that Hide and Seek facility previously received the benefit of the Probation Act for opening it unknown to parents without appropriate registration.
Okay, so things seem to be moving in the right direction, but I gather that's taken a turn of late. What's happening now at Hide and Seek?
Well, in recent days, we've been contacted by a number of parents who say they've learned that those new staff members I mentioned have in the past week left their positions. Now, it's understood some of the staff concerns centred on the failure to meet milestones and implement policy change within the company. A new branch manager at one of Hide and Seek's other facilities is also thought to have left her position, as have several frontline childcare workers working across the company's creches. It's further understood that an external expert recruited by Hide and Seek to implement company-wide changes has also parted ways with the company. Now, these developments, as you say, follow a decision by the High Court last week to grant an injunction pending arbitration, restraining Hide and Seek's insurer from cancelling the insurance policies for its four facilities. The insurance company's move arose from investigations by it arising from the RTE programme and subsequent media reports, and that matter separately has yet to be sorted out.
After everything that's happened, this news must again be quite distressing for parents whose children are still being cared for in these creches. You've been speaking to a number of them. What have they had to say?
Yeah, well, in recent days, as I say, we've been contacted by quite a number of parents. They don't wish to be identified because their children are still in these Hide and Seek creches. And we must remember that for many of these parents, they find themselves in a really tricky position. It's difficult to find alternative childcare in Dublin, and some of these families don't have support systems around them to help with childcare in an emergency situation. Now, one parent who spoke to us said they decided to leave their children in the Glasnevin creche because of the level of care afforded to their children every day by the dedicated staff. Those parents pushed for an overhaul of management, governance and a change in culture. They say while Hide and Seek's response was not immediate, it did eventually meet that demand. But now, they feel they're in a worse position now than when the programme aired back in July. For them, there's a sense that the old culture has returned to what it was pre the broadcast of the programme, and they feel commitments have not been followed through on, and communication is, in one parent's words, practically non-existent. Now, parents say a report by the external expert contracted by Hide and Seek, which was to be made available to them at the end of October, has also yet to materialise. All this means that once again, parents are having to consider their options, and we're aware that a number of families have secured childcare elsewhere in recent days. For others, they're concerned about what the future holds. They feel promises have been broken and they've been let down. One parent spoke to me about, on the one hand, it would be easier for them to remove their children and end the stress and sleepless nights that they've had over this whole affair. But on the other hand, given the sensitive age that many of their children are at, they don't want to remove them from their friends in case it causes them distress. And as they say, for these parents, the issue here is not about the level of care afforded to their children by frontline childcare workers, but rather this is an issue of governance, management and oversight.
Okay, Aoife, what has Hide and Seek had to say about all this?
Well, we're aware that additional inspections of all four Hide and Seek services were completed by Tusla officials in recent weeks. Those inspections followed the receipt of new complaints from concerned parents. We put all this to Hide and Seek last night, and in a statement to us, a spokesperson said the company is committed to providing quality childcare to all its families. They say this includes ensuring they have proper policies and procedures in place. The company confirmed a small number of staff who started recently have decided not to stay with them and they're being replaced quickly. Lastly, they say while they cannot comment on individual employees, Hide and Seek has a management structure in place and they say they have a full complement of staff.
Aoife, thank you. That's Aoife Hegarty of RTE Investigate.
The Taoiseach has rejected calls to deselect the Fine Gael candidate in the Wexford by-election. Fiona Murphy has stoked controversy with remarks about immigrants, homeless people and drink driving. Following her claims that ISIS was a big part of the migrant population in Ireland, she visited a reception centre for Syrian refugees and apologised. Last night, she pulled out of RTE Radio's Late Debate programme, which was focusing on the Wexford constituency. For more, let's talk to our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane. Micheál, looking at some of the quotes in this morning's papers from Fine Gael's opponents, words like shocking and incendiary are used. The Refugee Council described her as an inappropriate candidate for public office. Will Fine Gael continue to stand by her?
I think they will continue to look at it, but there was a sense I was getting within the party last night that maybe, just maybe, the worst of this storm has passed, but no one can be certain about that, given the many comments that have been made to media outlets. There's a possibility too that perhaps other things have been said in the course of the campaign that might emerge, not reported to the media, but said generally over the course of campaigning. That was one of the concerns. The Taoiseach was adamant in the Dáil, though, that he had spoken to Fiona Murphy and told her that her comments wasn't on, and saying to Breed Smith, who raised this in quite forceful terms, saying that the race card was being played here and that if this was allowed to continue, then it rested on the shoulders of the Taoiseach, saying in strong terms that it wouldn't be tolerated in Fine Gael and that he would have more experience of racism than Breed Smith would. That was the strong riposte that came back from the Taoiseach. In the wider party, though, much concern. They really do view this entire Wexford by-election now as a disaster zone, but something that they perhaps can't find their way out of. They will just have to endure it until the end. I know the Taoiseach had said earlier in the day at the broadband announcement that he would canvass with Fiona Murphy before polling day, but many people I spoke to in the Fine Gael parliamentary party last night and yesterday evening were appalled at the notion that they might have to travel to Wexford, and they certainly won't be doing that, even though they have canvassed in other by-election campaigns, the other three that are ongoing as well. Also, much frustration in the party at the fact that this was, for government, meant to be a good day, an announcement around the broadband contract signing, and yet it was Fiona Murphy's comments and that controversy that was in focus for much of the day.
She was due to appear on last night's Late Debate programme here on Radio 1. They were having a debate about the Wexford constituency. She withdrew, or was withdrawn, at pretty much the last minute.
Yeah, I think, as I understand it, Fiona Murphy made contact sometime after 6 o'clock with the programme, saying that in light of her apology and the visit to the Refugee Direct Provision Centre, that she wouldn't be doing any more media and that she would instead be focusing on issues of concern and listening to people in Wexford and focused on the constituency. Now, I spoke to a senior person within the party at around 4:30 yesterday evening, who at that point thought that the Late Debate would go ahead for Fiona Murphy, that was the plan. But something happened in the intervening period that made the party think twice about that. And I think that may be related to the intensity around the Fine Gael party in Leinster House and beyond, and the worry and concern at the idea that a 1 hour live radio debate would take place and Fiona Murphy would be speaking at length on that. There is a degree of concern and a degree of looking back with hindsight now about her entire selection that's being whispered about within party ranks, about the fact that Fiona Murphy was a very capable lobbyist, someone who had a high profile, someone who was a very good media performer. But questions being asked about, was sufficient emphasis being paid to that transition into politics, to the change of the rules when it comes to playing a political role? And that's something that is being reflected on now. But really that doesn't count for very much. It's about how Fine Gael handle the next few days up until November 29th that is in focus. Will this get worse? Or has the storm passed, as some in the higher parts of the party are hoping?
And are there those who believe that she could win in Wexford? Because I think it's fair to say in advance that maybe she would have been seen as one of the party's better chances in this string of by-elections.
Yeah, she was definitely seen as a strong contender, that was one of the ones that the government party was hoping to win. They said the target is one. Midwest probably was at the top of that list, but then they were looking to Wexford as well, which they thought would be a close race. No, you won't find anyone within Fine Gael, I haven't found them anyway, in the parliamentary party who think that is a possibility now. It's really about survival for the government side at this point over the next few days. This is something that has gone badly wrong. It's something that will still remain under scrutiny. I think the party's executive could meet in the next few days or at the weekend, and it's going to be discussed there as well. There is no winning of this by-election, many believe. I suppose the voters will still ultimately decide that. And we know the deadline, of course, for candidates registering was last Friday. Mm-hmm. So everything would suggest that Fiona Murphy will remain in this race. But I think try to keep a lower profile. And I suppose it isn't just the comments around immigration. Other comments in relation to housing, poverty, drink driving as well have been controversial, to say the least. And those charges against the government party and the Dáil yesterday, saying that it had become a home for right-wing politics.
Micheál, thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. Micheál Lehane there, our political correspondent. We did, by the way, ask Fine Gael for a spokesperson, but none was available. The other candidates in the Wexford by-election are Johnny Mithen of Sinn Féin, George Lawler of Labour, Karen Dubsky of the Green Party, Cinnamon Blackmore of People Before Profit, Jim Codd of Aonthu, Melissa O'Neill of the Irish Freedom Party, Malcolm Byrne of Fianna Fáil and independent Charlie Keddie.
There was no sign of a knockout blow last night as the two men vying to be British Prime Minister went head-to-head in the first televised leaders' debate. A significant part of the ITV programme was devoted to Brexit. The Conservatives' Boris Johnson and Labour's Jeremy Corbyn also clashed on the health service, the future of Scotland and the royal family. Perhaps the most unusual aspect of the debate was the fact that the audience laughed, and not in a good way, at both men. This report from Ailish Sheehy.
It's Boris Johnson versus Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes, we certainly will come out on January the 31st because we have a deal that, as I say, is oven ready. It's ready to go. And it's approved, as I say, not just by our friends and partners in the EU, but by every one of the 635 Conservative candidates. And it delivers everything that we wanted from Brexit.
The idea that the Prime Minister Boris Johnson's deal can be dealt with and finished by the end of January is such nonsense. What he's proposing is a trade deal with the United States that would take at least 7 years to negotiate, whilst at the same time saying he would negotiate a special trade deal with the European Union. The two things are actually incompatible.
On several occasions, Jeremy Corbyn was asked by Boris Johnson to clarify his position on whether he would campaign to stay or leave the European Union if another referendum was held.
Are you going to campaign for leave or remain?
I want to bring people together, therefore there will be a referendum in which that decision will be made by the British people and our government will abide by that decision.
When both men were asked if the union is worth sacrificing for Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn described the Prime Minister's deal as doing just that.
I hope the union is not going to be broken up or sacrificed in this way, but the agreement that the Prime Minister negotiated, or he's put towards to Parliament, was about creating a border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, creating a different customs arrangement for Northern Ireland with the rest of Ireland, having promised to the Democratic Unionist Party he would never do that.
Boris Johnson denying this claim.
Well, we have a deal that keeps the whole of the UK together as we come out of the EU. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, be in no doubt about it, in order to secure power and the keys to number 10, are going to do a deal, and they probably already have done a deal, with Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP to form a Corbyn-Sturgeon coalition. And the price of that deal, the price of Nicola Sturgeon's support, let's be in no doubt, she's made it absolutely clear, would be a second referendum on the union with Scotland.
However, Jeremy Corbyn described the comments as nonsense and knocked down any suggestion of a coalition with Labour and the SNP, saying no deals will be done. In a separate matter, the Prime Minister was reminded that he previously said a division down the Irish Sea would damage the fabric of the union.
Northern Ireland is part of the customs territory of the UK. It's there in black and white. And what the people of Northern Ireland do not know, and part of our tariff schedules and everything else, what the people of Northern Ireland do not know, and nor do the people of Ireland, is what kind of deal Jeremy Corbyn proposes to do. Okay.
He said exactly the opposite when he spoke to a DUP conference. You said there would be no border down the Irish Sea. And well, there is.
Ending on a lighter note and looking ahead to the festive season, they were asked what gifts they would leave under the Christmas tree for each other.
Well, I know Mr. Johnson likes a good read. So what I would probably leave under the tree for him would be A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And he could... And he can then understand how nasty Scrooge was.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
I would probably leave a copy of, since you want a literary effort, a copy of my brilliant Brexit deal.
Boris Johnson ending that report by Ailish Sheehy. Will have more on that debate later in the programme. It's 7:29.
Chinese retail giant Alibaba looks set to raise almost $13 billion in what will be the biggest share flotation in Hong Kong for nearly a decade. Alibaba is set to sell 500 million shares in a secondary listing following its initial flotation in New York in 2014. Asia's biggest company has called the listing a vote of confidence in Hong Kong's markets as it's racked by months of violent protests and the China-US trade war, which have sent its economy into recession. Origin Enterprises has reported a 13.7% dip in revenue in the 3 months to the end of October. The group said there had been a slower start to trading in what is already its quiet first quarter. That saw revenues fall to €371.2 million, with a particularly sharp dip in its Irish and British operations. Meanwhile, the parent company of the B&Q DIY chain has reported a 3.1% fall in sales in the 3 months to the end of October. Kingfisher had sales of less than £3 billion, with sales in France falling by 6%. Sales in Ireland and the UK were up slightly at almost £1.3 billion. Finally, for now, the currency markets, €1 buying you $1 and 10.7 cent and 85.7 pence sterling.
John Murray is here and Jose Mourinho is back.
I think your first question was, are they mad?
Well, that was certainly the question I asked off air.
Yes, right. Indeed.
And I'd say there are a lot of people out there this morning saying, are they mad?
Yes, well, they don't hang around, let's say that much for them. Jose Mourinho confirmed this morning as Spurs' new manager just hours after the club sacked Argentine Mauricio Pochettino. And this is how BBC Radio 5 Live broke the news in the last hour.
Breaking news this morning at 6:39.
Oh my goodness.
John Wilkinson's here.
Tottenham have appointed the former Chelsea and Manchester United boss Jose Mourinho as head coach.
You're kidding.
It doesn't come as a surprise, does it? We were just talking about it. It was highly expected and it has happened perhaps even sooner than we might have expected. His contract will run until the end of the 2022-23 season. He's won 25 senior trophies, league European titles, and now he's heading to Spurs to replace Mauricio Pochettino, sacked just last night.
We've got a statement. Here we are. Shall I?
We are delighted to announce the appointment of Jose Mourinho as head coach on a contract that runs until the end of the 2022-23 season. Jose is one of the world's most accomplished managers.
This is the chairman of Spurs, Daniel Levy, commenting on his appointment. In Jose, we have one of the most successful managers in football. He has a wealth of experience, can inspire teams, and is a great tactician. He has won honours at every club he coached. We believe he will bring energy and belief to the dressing room. And this is what Jose said.
He said, I'll do it in my voice. Speaking of his appointment, he said, I'm excited to be joining a club with such a great heritage and such passionate supporters. The quality in both the squad and the academy excites me. Working with these players is what has attracted me.
Yes, what do you reckon?
A broken dressing room. Jose's really what they need.
Yes. Yes, and it's rough on Pochettino, although it has to be said, despite making it to the Champions League final back in May, Spurs have only won 3 of their opening 12 Premier League games and are in 14th place in the table.
I see that Diego Maradona had been free as well. He had just resigned or quit or been sacked from his post after 2 months with an Argentinian club. It was too late for Spurs.
They stopped short of appointing Maradona. That would be a bridge too far, I'd say. In other news, the Republic of Ireland are Slovakia bound for a semi-final playoff for next summer's Euro 2020 finals. I see that return flights to Bratislava are up to about €370 now. The news was confirmed last night as Wales booked an automatic berth in the finals with a 2-0 win over Hungary at Cardiff City Stadium. Aaron Ramsey with both goals. It means the Republic will play Slovakia on March 26th next, and if they win, they will play the winners of the other playoff semi-final between.
It's a one-off game then, yeah?
A one-off game, one-legged game, yes, and if they win it, they will play the winners of the other playoff semi-final, which will be between Bosnia and Northern Ireland for a place in the finals. And this Friday, a draw will take place as to who will have home advantage in that final, which will take place 5 days later on March 31st. So that's the story from the Euro 2020 perspective. Wales, as I said, secured their place at the final, and not a great finish though for Northern Ireland in their qualifying campaign. They were beaten 6-1 in Germany, despite taking the lead through Michael Smith. Serge Gnabry scored a hat-trick for the Germans. The Irish under-21s, well, they remain on top of their qualifying group for Euro 2021 after a 4-1 win over Sweden at Tala Stadium last night. They came from 1-0 behind at half-time. Second-half goals from O'Connor, Ida, Parrott and El Buzedi gave them victory. The under-21s remain top of their group with a 3-point advantage, although second-placed Italy have 2 games in hand. Afterwards, Tony O'Donoghue spoke to a very happy Stephen Kenny.
We scored 4, we could have got 8, you know, we really could have, like, and I think in that second half, and you know, I think some of the play was just brilliant. It was nothing short of brilliant in the second half, and that's credit to the players for their showing their individual talent. Also, such a young team, like Gavin Bazunu and Troy Parra are 17, you know, and you know, and a lot of those players like Jason Knight and Nathan Collins who come in tonight, they're 18. You know,
there's clearly a buzz around this group. You maintain your advantage at the top of what's going to be a tight table. But you can see already a few of them are moving up into senior. Aaron Connolly was a part of this group only recently.
Yeah, well, Aaron Connolly, Troy Parrott and Leo Connor, of course, have all been capped at senior international level now. So that's good progression. The problem is we're losing our best players. That's the nature of it. That's what you want. You want them to push on.
That's Stephen Kenny there. In rugby news, Ulster will be without Jack McGrath, Sam Carter and Rob Little for their Champions Cup game against Clermont on Friday night. McGrath is to have surgery on a thumb injury, Carter on a dislocated shoulder. Little has a shoulder injury also. In golf, today is the final day of the European Tour's qualifying school in Spain. The top 25 in ties get cards for next season. Jonathan Caldwell is tied for 25th place at 9 under. Niall Kearney is a shot further back on 8 under, while Gavin Moynihan is on 6 under. There's racing today at Dundalk. The first is off at 2:25. For more on Jose Mourinho's appointment and the rest of the sports news, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
Today is Universal Children's Day. It also marks the first anniversary of the introduction to Ireland of an anti-bullying programme for schools. It's called Kiva, means kind or nice in the Finnish language, and provides training and tools to schools in how to address and prevent bullying. A survey of almost 3,000 children indicates it has had a positive impact on reducing bullying. One of the 18 primary schools it's now in use in is Marymount National School in Ballsgrove in Drogheda in County Louth. Elaine Keogh reports.
It is the end of another busy day in the 297 pupil school. Along with their other subjects, the boys and girls in Marymount National School have Kiva lessons as part of the SPHE programme. School Principal Barbara English said the programme helps the children to identify what bullying actually is.
Well, bullying can come in all shapes and forms, from a simple, what the children would call the look, where somebody is giving somebody the look, down to verbal abuse, calling names, pushing, shoving, any type of repeated unwanted behaviour. And that to us was the beauty of the Kiva programme, in the sense that it helps the children to understand the difference between he hit me, which is not necessarily bullying, or this person keeps annoying me and keeps coming after me and I feel uncomfortable and I don't like it. And that, to us, that was a big part of the first year of learning for the children.
Sinead Crilly teaches 4th and 5th class and is part of the Kiva team in the school. She says the programme gives children the tools to be more than a bystander to bullying.
It's very structured. It gives the children language, such as the bystander, which means they don't have to be the person being bullied or doing the bullying. If they see it, they are involved, whether they report it or not. So we're encouraging them to report it. So that if they see bullying, we used to have a slogan, "Bully Free Starts With Me," so that they can make changes across the school, not just if they're the victim or if they're the perpetrator. But I feel that it is having an impact and reducing the kind of incidences.
Vicky Gregory has 2 children in the school and 1 who has just moved on to secondary school. She says no parent wants to get a call from school about bullying, and in a digital world, cyberbullying is a particular challenge.
It all advances so quickly, so you're just getting the hang of one thing and it's totally changed. But it's, if you can, again, it comes back to when kids are young, if you can instill in them that any kind of bullying is wrong, but how specifically cyberbullying can be done so easily and can affect people in a way you don't see, because you're looking at a screen. So you need to get children even from a very young age to understand this. And devices are being handed to children, and I'm guilty of it myself, from a much younger age as well now. It's the norm for them.
Principal Barbara English says cyberbullying is addressed in the Kiva programme.
The Kiva programme has a big element of cyberbullying, particularly in the unit for the senior children, but I think we feel at this stage, looking at our statistics, we need to take it back towards the younger children and get in there early and educate them as to how dangerous even one wrong remark can be in terms of bullying.
Hugh Dugan is the programme manager for the Genesis programme. It is a consortium of early learning and care centres, schools, community and statutory groups who are working to improve the future for children in areas of disadvantage. The Genesis programme has the licence for Kiva in Ireland, and Hugh Dugan said 1 year on from its introduction, a survey of almost 3,000 primary school children has found it is having an impact.
In 2018, the number of students who had been bullied 2 or 3 times a month or more was actually at 24%. And that was, you know, that was a figure that started a lot of people, that effectively equated to 1 in 4 students. But a lot of bullying is hidden. It's out of sight, you know, it's in the corner of the schoolyard where there's nobody on duty or whatever. But that figure has come down. So it's gone from 24% in 2018 to just 18% now. So that's a significant decrease. And if you flip it over then, the students who've been bullied other people 2 or 3 times a month or more was stood at 9% in 2018. That's now at 5%. So it's working that less students are being bullied, there's less students bullying others. So that's key.
And what of the children themselves? I spoke to some 5th class girls about their Kiva posters and how Kiva makes them feel.
I think we feel safe and happy and that we respect each other more.
I think it has made a difference. Because, like, if someone gets bullied in our yard and we've learned about Kiva, we'll know how to solve the problem.
It makes me feel happy and safe because we do loads of lessons and we treat each other with respect and everyone has fun together and we all play together in the yard.
I didn't think there was any bullying in our school, not that I've heard of anyway, but it definitely helped people not to even try bully someone, so they know how to deal with something if it does happen.
Some of the pupils in 5th class in Marymount National School in Drogheda ending that report from Elaine Keogh. Liveline here on RT Radio 1 in recent weeks has received several calls from victims of bullying over the years who shared their stories. One caller, Gerard, was a victim of bullying and abuse in school. He then became a bully, and 46 years later, he went to see his victim and apologised.
We're 2 old men now, not 2 12-year-olds, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, I'm here for a reason, and as if he knew what the reason was, I said to him, look, I just want to apologise for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Within seconds of me saying so, he says, no, he says, you're all right. He says, and it was as if he knew that I was always going to appear. What happened, happened. He said, I accept your apology. And was more than polite to me.
That's nice. More than polite. That's good.
And within minutes, he tried to change the conversation to how his life, how he was telling me about his family, everything, you know, just to put me off, because he could see the stress that I was under, or the anxiety, I suppose you'd call it.
Okay.
We spoke for maybe half an hour, 40 minutes, about everything. A lot of things in those few minutes, I won't ever forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And I shook hands with him and drove away with a big burden off my back.
That's Gerard speaking to Joe Duffy on RTE's Liveline. Let's speak to James O'Higgins Norman. He's UNESCO Chair on Tackling Bullying in Schools and Cyberspace. He's also the Director of the Anti-Bullying Research and Resource Centre at DCU. Professor O'Higgins Norman, thank you very much for taking our call this morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Since 2013, all schools in Ireland are required to find an anti-bullying programme that works for their school. How are they getting on?
Yes, so the government introduced a national action plan in 2013 which required schools to identify a anti-bullying program and then adapt it for local use in their own school. We undertook research at DCU with all of the schools, primary and post-primary, and we found that about half of them are doing really well. They have their policy in place and they've identified a program and they're implementing it, whereas the other half of the schools are struggling. They tell us it's because they don't have time, they don't have resources, and they don't have the expertise to investigate and to identify a program that would work in their school.
Yes, the experience of many parents who try to get their child's school to stop bullying is that if there is a policy, it's often a box-ticking exercise, and for many children, it's a case of maybe a once-a-year awareness campaign. Is that widespread in your view?
Yes, it is. I suppose there are two types of school when it comes to bullying. There are those that, as you described, they tick a box, maybe once a year have an anti-bullying week in the school, which tries to promote awareness of friendship and kindness and empathy, and then kind of everything is forgotten about them for another 12 months once that week is over. We're really excited then when we come across schools that actually embed anti-bullying work and prevention into the daily life of the school. They take a whole school approach, which starts with the leader in the school, the principal, who prioritizes the issue, and then because he or she prioritizes the issue, it becomes a priority for the whole school community. So the whole school approach is something that happens all year round, and I suppose there's a difference between bullying prevention and bullying intervention. And if we do enough of the bullying prevention, then there should be less of a need to do the intervention when it does occur.
And as we're hearing on Liveline in recent weeks, the effects of being bullied at a young age often have lifelong impacts.
Yes, it has an impact on everybody who's involved. Obviously, our biggest concern and our most immediate concern is always for the person who's the victim or the target of the bullying behaviour. It can cause them to have terrible self-esteem issues, feel alienated from the school, feel fearful about friendships. Long term, it can contribute to depression and even suicidal ideation. But the bully who's actually part of the process as well is also damaged by being a bully. Often they are acting out of some trauma or anger or aggression that they've experienced in their own life. And then those who witness the bullying, we have research coming out now that shows that those people actually carry a burden of guilt for not intervening, and that can stay with them for many, many years afterwards.
James O'Higgins Norman, thank you very much for speaking to us on the programme today. We'll have business and weather next.
Adam Maguire is here now with the Business News. Morning, Adam.
Morning, Rachel. There is a growing desire among businesses to become more sustainable, though many will wonder how they can do so without putting their bottom line under significant pressure. The Sustainable Business Summit being held in Dublin this morning will hopefully go some way to answering that. The keynote speaker is Steve Howard, who is the former Chief Sustainability Officer at IKEA. But before he takes the stage, he joins us on the line now. Steve, I suppose when people hear sustainability, they probably think going green, but it is important to point out that for you anyway, it's a much broader concept than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really looking at how you future-proof your business. And if you think of the big issues that are shaping the world today, from a sustainability point of view. I mean, we've heard about sort of really big impacts on biodiversity. We've lost pretty much 60 to 70% of the plants and animals over the last 50 years. Plastic pollution in the oceans, but the biggie, obviously, is climate change. And this is really, it's become an issue that business leaders have to address now. It's not something you can wait for the next CEO to come along. So that's the sort of conversation we've got here in PwC today is with about 150 business leaders to go deep into that and look at what do you do, how do you lead change in your business so you can switch to renewable energy, so you can switch to electric vehicle fleets, so you can make sure your value chain is really supporting positive impacts on the environment rather than negative ones.
The likes of IKEA obviously have huge resources behind them to a lot of influence as well on suppliers and partners, but how would a small business make the kind of change that's required?
You know, there's always this contradiction where people think sustainability should somehow be a cost, that somehow it's actually going to be, it's a better idea to run an unsustainable business. So whether you're small or large, this is about being efficient in your use of resources, thinking about things you can design products that will last a long time, that you can have materials that come from renewable, sustainable resources like sustainable forestry. So you can think of those things if you're a small business. The interesting thing now is, in the same way we've seen innovation in the digital world, you can see innovation driven by sustainability. There's lots of small startups around the world doing things from looking at plant-based proteins to produce great foods, or there's even a company that's doing leather from mushrooms. These are breakthrough products that are better for people, better for the environment, better for the bottom line. So people are creating business opportunities. So I think you just have to think this is the new way of doing business, whether you're small or large.
Very briefly, you talk a lot about going all in and being decisive on sustainability. Why is that a better approach than and maybe taking smaller, steady steps that businesses might be more inclined to take?
Yeah. When I was at IKEA, it became really clear if you put a 100% target in place, you're really clear about what the future looks like. So we set a 100% target for renewable energy. We switched to 100% LED light bulbs and things like that. If you have a 50% target, you leave the business completely confused. Are you backing the future or are you just staying with the past? So I always say go all in around sustainability and create fantastic sustainable products that are good for customers and good for the environment.
Steve Herrod, thank you very much for that. More business news in the next hour. For now, though, it's back to you, Gavin.
Let's get a weather forecast now. Liz Coleman is at Met Aaron. Morning, Liz.
Thanks, Gavin, and good morning from Met Aaron. Well, quite a wet start for the East Coast and for parts of South Munster, with some heavy pulses of rain this morning. And there'll be outbreaks of rain in many areas today. The rain will be heaviest over Munster and South Leinster, where we have a yellow rainfall warning in operation, with the risk of some spot flooding here. Highest temperatures of 9 to 11 degrees with moderate to fresh southerly winds becoming strong and gusty in coastal areas of Leinster. Further outbreaks of rain overnight, heaviest over East Munster and South Leinster. Staying windy and moderate to fresh southeast winds with lows of 4 to 7 degrees. And tomorrow will be mostly a cloudy day with scattered outbreaks of rain, the heaviest and prolonged falls continuing across the south and east, so a continued risk of spot flooding here. Southeast winds will moderate through the day with highest temperatures of 7 to 9 degrees. Generally cloudy on Thursday night and rain will become patchier and mainly affecting northern and eastern areas. Winds will ease overnight with lows of 2 to 6 degrees. Some uncertainty over the weather from Friday onwards, but it currently looks like some areas of the west will have dry weather at first. But showers or showery rain will occur, especially in the east, where they could turn quite heavy towards evening. Winds will be generally light easterly, with highest temperatures of 7 to 10 degrees. Outbreaks of rain continuing overnight on Friday, turning heavy and persistent in parts of the east and south. Overnight lows of 0 to plus 6 degrees, with some frost possible in southwest areas under clear skies. Further scattered outbreaks of rain on Saturday, although it will tend to become patchier towards evening. Highs of 6 to 9 degrees in light to moderate east or variable winds. And current indications for Sunday are for a dry start, but thickening cloud will bring outbreaks of rain into the south in the morning. And that rain will spread countrywide through the afternoon. Highs of 7 to 10 degrees. So to recap on today, outbreaks of rain heaviest in East Munster and South Leinster with a risk of some spot flooding. That's your forecast. Have a great day.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 20th of November. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English. With the news in detail, here's Brian Jennings.
A survey published today suggests that the number of smokers in Ireland has fallen by 165,000 over the past 5 years. The annual Healthy Ireland survey is funded by the Department of Health and conducted by Ipsos MRBI. Kate Carlin reports.
17% of the population are now smokers, down from 23% 4 years ago. Nearly 7,500 people, aged 15 and older, were interviewed for this survey, which was carried out between September 2018 and September 2019. One in four smokers said the plain cigarette packaging with health warnings that were introduced last year encouraged them to stop. Of those surveyed, 40% said they had tried to kick the habit over the past 12 months, citing health concerns as the main reason. Smoking rates among the 25 to 34 age group remain highest, while smoking rates are also high among people who are unemployed or living in deprived areas.
Northern Ireland's future in the United Kingdom and the Irish border were among the issues addressed by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the leader of the Labour Party Jeremy Corbyn during a televised debate last night. They disagreed over Brexit and management of the National Health Service. From Manchester, our reporter Dimitri O'Donnell.
Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn spent the first half of the debate clashing over Brexit. The Prime Minister said a vote for the Conservatives would finally get Brexit done by January 31st. Jeremy Corbyn said Mr. Johnson could not deliver on his promises. He claimed Labour would sort Brexit by giving the public the final say in a second referendum, but he did not reveal which side his party would take. A snap poll after the debate suggested a tie. With Election Day in just over 3 weeks and the Conservatives holding a double-digit lead in most polls, Labour hopes the split result will help close that gap. Dimitri O'Donnell, RTE News, Manchester.
Twitter has accused the British Conservative Party of misleading the public by changing the name of one of its Twitter accounts to make it look like a fact-checking service during the debate. The Conservative Campaign Headquarters Press Office account, followed by nearly 76,000 users, changed its name to Fact Check UK. Messages of support for Boris Johnson were posted to the account during the debate. Twitter said it would take decisive corrective action if what it described as a similar stunt was attempted again. The Tories said that it was clear throughout that it was a Conservative Party account. A key witness in the impeachment inquiry into the US President Donald Trump is due to testify today. The US Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, has been accused by other witnesses of being centrally involved in efforts to get Ukraine to investigate the former US Vice President Joe Biden, who's seeking the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Democrats have accused US President Donald Trump of threatening to withhold military aid from Ukraine to pressure the country into opening a corruption investigation into his political rival Joe Biden. The US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, has been accused by other witnesses in the impeachment inquiry of being centrally involved in the scheme and of being in regular contact with Donald Trump about the matter. Ambassador Sondland is due to testify in a public hearing on Capitol Hill later today. Last night, the former US Special Envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, gave evidence that he was unaware that efforts to pressure Ukraine to open anti-corruption investigations were targeting Joe Biden. He described the scheme as unacceptable and said he would have raised objections if he knew then what he knows now. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
Two firearms have been seized by Gardaí in Limerick City. The weapons were found during a search of a house in Ballynanty in the city's north side yesterday evening. Three men were arrested. A man in his 60s had died in a road crash in County Sligo. The man was driving a car that was in collision with a van at Carra Row, 5 kilometres south of Sligo town, at around 7 o'clock last night. Researchers at Queen's University Belfast have said that noise pollution is threatening the survival of more than 100 species. They found that noise affects the behaviour of a wide range of animals and should be considered as a global pollutant. Scientists say that it prevents some animals escaping predators. Conversely, it can also inhibit some animals in their quest to find prey. Many birds will avoid noise-polluted areas during migration, which in turn affects where they will establish their long-term homes to raise their young. Now the time is exactly 6 minutes past eight.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Any early frost in inland areas will soon clear. Today will be generally cloudy with showers or longer spells of rain over much of the country. The rain will be heaviest over Munster and South Leinster, with a likelihood of spot flooding. Highest temperatures will be around 11 degrees.
7 minutes past eight with It Says in the Papers. Here's Clodagh Walsh.
The fallout from comments made by Fine Gael's by-election candidate in Wexford, Verona Murphy, still continues to make headlines. The lead story for The Examiner, it says Fine Gael has been branded a safe house for right-wing politicians after the Taoiseach continued to back by-election candidate Miss Murphy, who claimed asylum seekers need to be deprogrammed when they come here. That echoed in the lead in the Irish Independent. It says the Taoiseach is backing Verona Murphy despite coming under pressure from some in his own party to abandon her candidacy. Matt Cooper, in his column in the Irish Daily Mail, writes that the Taoiseach's reaction to Verona Murphy's comments on immigration smacks of cynicism. Gerard Howland in The Examiner writes, "Our public conversation is trending down. Words matter and this must be addressed." And writing on the same subject, Miriam Lord in The Irish Times says the only person who could have possibly made a better job of ruining the government's meticulously planned PR job surrounding the signing of the National Broadband Plan yesterday is the Duke of York. And there's much coverage again today of said Duke, Britain's Prince Andrew, of his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, his personal finances, and a call once again for him to speak to the FBI. The other story dominating the front pages is that of a man whose remains were found in a burning car in Lucan in County Dublin on Monday night. The Irish Daily Star, The Mirror, The Irish Sun and The Herald all report that the body was so badly burned, DNA testing will be required to identify him. Gardaí believed the dead man may be a criminal from County Dublin reported missing and who had survived a previous shooting. The main story in the Irish Times reports that the head of claims at the state's largest public sector insurer said that courts must not only throw out fabricated and inflated claims, but impose costs and send fraudsters to prison. Michael Whelehan was speaking at a conference organised by Insurance Ireland yesterday. And elsewhere on its front page, a report which says that the state faces legal and other costs estimated at up to €4 million following the settlement of a case taken by Aoife Bennett of Naas, County Kildare, who developed narcolepsy after being administered with a swine flu vaccine. And there's much coverage of this story in all the papers, as there is of the first live televised leaders' debate in the British general election. And the general consensus seems to be that neither British Prime Minister Boris Johnson or Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn came out on top. And Michelle Murphy, writing in The Star, says that with the Brexit deadline just over 2 months away, it is time for the government here to look at how it can support low-income households from the impact of Brexit. And the sale by RTÉ of some of its paintings provides the front page lead story for the Irish Daily Mail. It says the controversial decision to sell off the works of art, including two pieces by Louis Le Brocq, backfired yesterday as the paintings failed to sell for the prices expected. Some of the paintings that went on sale in London had to be withdrawn. And finally, several papers this morning report that an airport worker who slipped into an aircraft hold for a sleep could have died after he was mistakenly locked in by a colleague shortly before the aircraft was due to take off. The worker had a lucky escape after a passenger on board heard loud banging coming from the hold. And the issue came to light in a case before the Workplace Relations Commission, and the incident took place at an unnamed Irish airport in 2016.
Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn went head to head last night in the first televised leaders' debate of Britain's election campaign. It's fair to say that it wasn't a debate for the ages, with both men repeating familiar ideas and phrases. The Conservative leader repeatedly said that he would get Brexit done, while the Labour leader refused to be drawn on which side he would take in any future referendum. There was controversy off air over the way the Tories rebranded a campaign Twitter account as a fact fact-checking service. Twitter says the move misled the public. Our reporter Dimitri O'Donnell was in the so-called spin room at the venue in Salford outside Manchester. Dimitri, let's talk first of all about the substance of the debate. Unlike the rest of the campaign, there was actually a significant focus on Brexit.
That's right, Rachel. And the way that the debate was set up, the first half of it focused exclusively on Brexit. After the opening statements, they were given 1 minute each to lay out and state their case, and then they went back to talk about Brexit, the fine details of Brexit, if you like. But as you said earlier, it wasn't a debate for the ages, because instantly Boris Johnson, right off the blocks, repeated his old mantra, his old phrase that he was the only leader that could get Brexit done. He was the one who had a deal ready, oven ready, to quote himself. And he said that all of his MP candidates, all 650, were prepared to go back to Parliament and vote for his deal if he got a majority. And that was one of the early points that he pressed home in the debate. Jeremy Corbyn, by contrast, he stated his lines as well, that he wanted to leave the Brexit, final Brexit decision up to the people, and to give them a second chance, to give them a second chance to vote in a referendum. But he didn't, of course, state, and he was got a lot of criticism for this after, for not stating how Labour would vote in this. Now, I spoke to Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, afterwards, and he was the former Brexit Secretary as well, and I asked him who he thought the clear winner, and predictably he said, of course, Boris Johnson, but he had some hard words for Jeremy Corbyn.
Jeremy Corbyn needed a knockout blow in this election debate, and he didn't get it. I thought that he looked very shifty, unable to answer nine times the critical question on Brexit, which way he would vote, which way he would campaign, the central issue in this election debate. If he can't answer that question, why should the voters trust him on anything else? I think he put his best shots at Boris Johnson on the NHS, and Boris from the heart had the standout moment in this debate when he said, this NHS will never be up for sale on my watch. And I think he then went on to set out his positive plan, the investment in the NHS and hospitals, on doctors, on nurses, on new treatments, and I think he won it hands down.
Dominic Raab of the Conservatives. Dimitri, the audience played quite a big part in the debate. I mean, there was more than one point at which they laughed at what the two leaders were saying, and not in a good way either.
No, absolutely not. And this is plays into the whole idea that they weren't really tempted by either Jeremy Corbyn or Boris Johnson. And that's one of the key messages that came out after this debate, Rachel, because a snap poll by YouGov after pretty much put it as a virtual tie. The Prime Minister slightly edged ahead by 51% to Jeremy Corbyn's 49%. But as you said, they repeatedly laughed at various points throughout the debate. One of the biggest laughs came when a question about trust came up from one of the members of the public. And Boris Johnson said, of course, he believes in trust in politics and that he was very much in favour of that. That got a lot of chuckles. But Mr. Corbyn, he did not escape any laughter either, because especially because of his repeated failure to dance around the question of whether he would back, leave or remain in a future referendum. And then it all got a bit silly afterwards, where they talked about what Christmas presents they would give each other if they were to leave a present under the tree, and what book they would give. Mr. Corbyn said he would give Boris Johnson a copy of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, so Mr. Johnson could then understand how nasty Scrooge was. The Prime Minister said if he was to give Jeremy Corbyn a present, it would be his Brexit deal that he negotiated with all the EU27. But then when he was asked to go for a non-political answer, he said he would give him some damps and jam. And Mr. Corbyn retorted by saying, I make my own jam, because he's a well-known horticulturist. So there was a lot of silliness, but a lot of laughter around those key issues on trust, which neither will be quite happy about. Now, I spoke to Dawn Butler on the Labour side. She's the Shadow Secretary for Women and Equalities. And I asked her directly about why Jeremy Corbyn danced around his position, why he won't come out and state, if there is a second referendum, what way the Labour Party would vote.
Jeremy Corbyn is a democratic type of leader, not an autocratic leader, he's a democratic type of leader. And as Prime Minister, he doesn't want to implement what he wants. He wants to implement what the country wants. So he has clearly said, in 6 months, we will put Brexit to bed. And what does that look like? I can tell you what that looks like. That means that people will have a second referendum, a people's vote, a confirmatory vote, however you want to phrase it. And on that paper, it will have a credible leave option and remain. And Jeremy Corbyn, as Prime Minister, within 6 months, will deliver what the public have said they want.
Labour's Dawn Butler. Dimitri, tell us about this Twitter row.
Yes, well, this could well end up, Rachel, being the story of the debate last night. Not on policies, not on manifestos, but on this move by the Conservative Party to rebrand its official Twitter account, one of the press accounts, as a fact-checking service. Just before the debate kicked off last night, it renamed its account Fact Check UK for the duration of the debate. And then they started to write commentary under the Fact Check UK Twitter handle. For example, one of the tweets they put out is after the debate was, Boris Johnson is the clear winner. Now, there is a fact-checking website in the UK and it's called Full Fact. And a lot of Twitter users, members of the media and Twitter itself has said it was inappropriate and misleading Conservatives to rename their Twitter account during the debate. And Full Fact itself has come out and said, please do not mistake it for an independent fact-checking service such as Full Fact, Fact Checked or Fact Check NI. So you can see why some viewers may have been a bit confused with all the facts and the fulls and the Twitter, the official Conservative account going down that road. Some said it was a stunt, a tactic that backfired on the Conservative Party. Twitter itself says they will be monitoring the Conservatives to see if they will pull a similar move down the line. But it hasn't gone down very well here in the UK, and expect a lot of blowback for the Conservatives throughout the day as all of their senior politicians and secretaries have been coming out today trying to defend the move, including Dominic Raab, who said it was quite clear that it was, if you looked at it within 2 or 3 seconds, you would have realised it was a Conservative account. But a lot of viewers and members of the public not quite so sure about that.
Dimitri O'Donnell in Salford, thanks for joining us this morning.
Will more people who say that their illness was caused by a swine flu vaccine go to court now after one woman settled her case yesterday? Aoife Bennett from Naison, County Kildare, claimed she developed narcolepsy, a life-changing sleep disorder, as a result of receiving Pandremix, that's a vaccine for swine flu, at school 10 years ago when she was 16. In her High Court action, it was claimed that the vaccine hadn't been properly tested and that there were inadequate warnings about potential side effects. Her claims were denied, and the vaccine maker GlaxoSmithKline said no link had been established between narcolepsy and Pandremix. The case was settled without admission of liability. Aoife Bennett's costs will be paid by the HSE and the Minister for Health, but not by the other two plaintiffs, the Health Products Regulatory Authority and the drug company. Full details of the settlement have not been made public. Aoife Bennett's mother, Mary, was on drive time last evening.
The case was very difficult on Aoife and could have continued for a long, long time yet. Mm. And I suppose we're just an ordinary family, and it's a very difficult task taking on the state and taking on a multinational company like GSK. The state has unlimited funds to defend this case, but unfortunately a family like us wouldn't have that.
That's Aoife Bennett's mother, Mary, speaking to Mary Wilson on RTE's Drive Time yesterday. The Minister for Health and the HSE are not available to us this morning. The State Claims Agency told us that they did not seek a confidentiality undertaking from the plaintiff or her family. Ty Kennedy is secretary of a group called Sound, sufferers of unique narcolepsy disorder. He's the father of 16-year-old Jack, who suffers from narcolepsy. Ty Kennedy, good morning. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Morning, Gavin. Yeah, no problem.
Can you tell us about Jack and about his narcolepsy?
Jack and his narcolepsy. Jack, by coincidence, Jack was inoculated and got the vaccine on the very same day that Aoife did, on the 10th of December 2009. He is one of three siblings. Three boys were brought by their mum to get the vaccination because they were at that age. They were the young, vulnerable age, and they were vaccinated. Jack developed the unique narcolepsy within a month. Within a month, he was displaying symptoms. So the court case yesterday may say that it wasn't a causal effect, but I would definitely, and we always maintained, it definitely was a large contributory factor in causing my son's narcolepsy. That's Pandemrix. And it was devastating. He's grown up with it. He is much younger than Aoife, so he is only 16 now. That's the age he actually got it. But he has spent most of his life with narcolepsy.
And tell me about the effect it's had on his life over the last 10 years now.
10 years, I would say the first two, before we got diagnosis and before we could get treatment and medication for it, that was the hellish bit, not knowing what's wrong with your child, not knowing why he just falls down or stumbles or was sleeping just odd times around the place or was having these crazy mental hallucinations, really petrifying mental hallucinations. After diagnosis, which happened late 2012, since then he has been a very, very heavily medicated young man. And he has progressed okay, but he is alive on medication now. And regular naps, pretty much, that's it. And that's a lifelong condition, that's the rest of his life.
What are you going to do now as a result of what happened yesterday? Because in Aoife Bennett's case, it was settled without admission of liability. So the objective of proving the issue of liability for cases like yours and the almost 100 similar cases hasn't been proved.
No, it hasn't been proved. I would say that I heard what I needed to hear on the first couple of days in court. We heard the opening statement that laid out the case that Pandemrix was not properly clinically trialed drug and it was used on a healthy population in this country. It had devastating effects on people. The management of the case then, when these reports were coming in about the adverse effects, it was totally mismanaged. That's what we always maintained. And the state then was just really, really, really painstakingly slow to react or do anything about it. And even after diagnosis and over the years, they've been very reluctantly, grudgingly giving anything to anybody that suffers with anything to do with narcolepsy, pandemics related narcolepsy, any of the supports, anything, are just so haphazard and ad hoc. That is the painful bit about it for a lot of people. It's just a mess. It's totally mismanaged. And I think that was the crux of seeking responsibility and liability in Aoife and our cases going into these four cases.
The case, as we said,
somebody has to stand up and fix it.
Yes, it was settled without admission of liability. So will you now proceed with the case yourself?
I'm presuming we're still on the list yet to go ahead. It's up to the government now. They have spent millions, and it's over like 5 or 6 years at least, fighting these cases before they ever went near a case. They were 12 visits into the courts just on the discovery of document stage. They have spent millions fighting and aggressively fighting this case, and it's just bonkers because, you know, the company DSK has settled these cases in other countries. They've definitely settled in the last 2 or 3 years in England. So why in the Irish system, why are we so aggressively fighting against our own people that basically went out and trusted the vaccination scheme and did it for the benefit of everybody, and this is the thanks you get when something goes wrong? You're put through this trauma.
In a statement provided to us by the Department of Health, they say that an expert group was established in June of last year to examine the law in relation to personal injuries arising in the healthcare context and to explore alternative mechanisms by which claims could be managed more effectively, particularly from the perspective of the person on whose behalf a claim has been made. A report from this expert group is expected in the coming weeks, the recommendations of which will be taken into account in relation to the development of any vaccine compensation scheme. Is that something that would be of interest, do you think, to you and indeed other people in the sound group?
I would take a very holistic view to that. Yes, absolutely yes. If you partake in any vaccination scheme, there's a beginning, a middle, and end. You take part of it, you look for herd immunity. If something goes wrong, if there's an adverse effect, you take care of, or you're taken care of. It's built into the program, or your vaccination program, but it isn't at the moment. The no-fault compensation scheme, yeah, another group is talking about it, Gavin.
Yes.
Yeah, that was first mooted in 2002. It's on the programme from government from 2016. I am aware of it, but in nearly 20 years, we haven't seen anything like a result in coming to any agreement about. No government has come to any agreement about how to establish that, so I wouldn't be holding my breath about that, but it is definitely something that should be in place.
Tyke, thank you very
much.
Too
late now for us.
Tyke, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning, and apologies for the difficulty with the quality of the line there. That's Tyke Kennedy. He's Secretary of Sufferers of Unique Narcolepsy Disorder, and he's also the father of 16-year-old Jack, who suffers from narcolepsy. It's 20 minutes past 8. The European Jewish Association has condemned the selling of Nazi artefacts by a German auction house. Adolf Hitler's top hat, Eva Braun's dresses, and a silver-coloured edition of Mein Kampf are among the items being put up for sale at Munich-based Hermann Historica. There's also a copy of Hitler's rental contract in Munich and a pair of sunglasses worn by defendants at the Nazi war crimes trials in Nuremberg to avoid the glare of the floodlights. Rabbi Menachem Margolin, chairman of the European Jewish Association, says, "We believe the sale of such memorabilia has little historical value, but instead will be bought by those who glorify and seek to justify the actions of the greatest evil to affect Europe." Let's speak to Gideon Falter. He's executive chairman of UK-based organisation Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. Gideon, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
What do you make of this sale?
These are the sorts of items that you would want to collect from a favourite rock star or some person that you revere and adore. These are not items which have some kind of historical value, and there are reasons why people might collect items from the Nazi era. They might collect items which are in some way commemorative of the crimes that they committed or something of that nature, but there's no reason why you would want to have, for any practical purpose, there's nothing that you would study, for example, if you're an academic, about Hitler's top hat. And there is no value or use for sunglasses worn by Nazi war criminals during their war crimes hearings in Nuremberg to avoid the glare of the floodlight. These are simply items that will be collected by people who glorify the Nazis and their reign of terror, during which millions of people were murdered, including 6 million Jews. And we think it's absolutely wrong that people are trading them as though they are items of memorabilia.
It's 8:30. I'll get to news headlines shortly. Maurice Cohen, who's the chairman of the Jewish Representative Council of Ireland, told us that the sale of Nazi memorabilia to neo-Nazis is to be condemned outright. If, on the other hand, they're sold to people or institutions that will use this memorabilia to make sure that humanity doesn't forget the absolute atrocities perpetrated by the Nazis or of the premeditated industrial slaughter of people, then it could serve as a continual reminder that we should and must never forget. Hermann Historica's director, Bernard Packer, was quoted by Bild Daily as saying, "Yes, Hitler sells, but most of all to customers who are approaching it with serious historical interest." Gideon, this auction, it's not unique. Is it part of a growing normalization of Nazism in Germany?
It's unclear, because really what this shows is greed by the people who own these items and are sort of trying to get their few euros out of it by selling them on. And it shows a complete lack of compassion and understanding for the victims of the Holocaust by the people like these auction houses who then go and market these items and try to sell them to the highest bidder. These are not being given to a museum or donated to a museum or even sold to a museum. These are being sold to the highest bidder. The bidders that will be attracted to something like this are people who glorify and worship and idolize people like Adolf Hitler and his wife Eva Braun and these Nazi war criminals who wore the sunglasses. These are not people okay. who are engaged in trying to protect the memory of the victims of the Nazis or trying to raise awareness about the horrors of what they committed.
Gideon, thank you very much for taking our call. That's Gideon Falter, Executive Chairman of Campaign Against Anti-Semitism.
It's 8:34. Adam Maguire joins us with the business headlines.
Thanks, Rachel. Origin Enterprises has warned that its annual profits will be less than expected following a slow start to the year. This morning, the agri-services business reported a 13.7% dip in revenue in the 3 months to the end of October. It blamed challenging weather on the performance, with sales in Ireland and the UK seeing a particularly sharp dip. Elsewhere, sales have fallen again at the parent company of DIY chain B&Q. Kingfisher had sales of less than £3 billion in the 3 months at the end of October, down 3.1% year on year. Its new CEO, Thierry Garnier, said the business was suffering from organisational complexity and was trying to do too much at once. Meanwhile, Chinese retail giant Alibaba looks set to raise almost $13 billion in what will be the biggest share flotation in Hong Kong for nearly a decade. Asia's biggest company has called the listing a vote of confidence in Hong Kong's markets as it's racked by months of violent protests and the China-US trade war. Finally, the currency markets, €1 buying you 85.7 pence sterling and $1 and 10.6 cent.
From the special one to the grumpy one to the Spursy one. Morning, John Murray.
Good morning to you, Gavin. Yes, the big news this morning, Jose Mourinho has been confirmed as Spurs' new manager just hours after the club sacked Argentine Mauricio Pochettino. It's a 3.5-year deal for the Portuguese. In Jose, we have one of the most successful managers in football, said Spurs chairman Daniel Levy. Mourinho himself said the quality in the squad and the academy excited him. After 5 years at the helm, Pochettino sacking last night came with Spurs, despite making it to the Champions League final back in May, only winning 3 of their opening 12 Premier League games and in 14th place in the league table. Let's talk now to our soccer correspondent and Spurs fan, Tony O'Donoghue. Tony, almost in the blink of an eye, it's bye-bye Mauricio. Hello, Jose. Your thoughts on this turn of events?
It happened really quickly, didn't it? He was sacked last night. Mourinho appointed. The official confirmation came at 29 minutes past 6 this morning. It staggered a lot of Spurs fans, I have to say. I've been on a lot of the WhatsApp groups, and they don't think Mourinho is a Tottenham Hotspur-style manager. Clearly, he's been a very successful manager, but he's usually needed an awful lot of money. And Daniel Levy, the Tottenham Hotspur chairman, is known to be parsimonious. And there's an ethos to Tottenham Hotspur as well, summed up by the great Danny Blanchflower. He says that the game is not about winning, it's about glory. It's about doing things in style with a flourish, about going out and beating the other lot, not waiting for them to die of boredom. And that's stitched into the Tottenham Hotspur new stadium, into their jersey, into their ethos. The glory game is what Spurs are supposed to be all about. Well, Mourinho is about the winning game. And I think he's going to see a club demotivated. You've seen the players come out this morning. Harry Kane just a short time ago thanking Mauricio Pochettino for what he did for him on a personal level, and he'll always be his friend. It's not Mourinho's way or his style to develop new talent and bring them into the club, which is what Pochettino has done. When you think of how Kane came through, Harry Winks coming through, Dele Alli wasn't through the Spurs Academy, but he went there at a very young age. It's such a worry for me as well that Troy Parrott, who's one of the Republic of Ireland's great hopes, he's only 17. This spells danger for him, I think, because he was being given a chance, being with the first team at Tottenham. He played in the League Cup. I'd worry now with Mourinho at the club that he won't get a look in. Mourinho always needs money. Pochettino was looking for money, didn't get it from Daniel Levy. Two transfer windows came and went, and Spurs didn't strengthen their squad. Now is suddenly Levy going to spend $12 million in paying off Pochettino and then give a transfer kitty to Mourinho as well? I think it's a very strange appointment.
All right, on to the other soccer news this morning. Confirmation, Tony, that we are Slovakia-bound for a semi-final playoff for next summer's Euro 2020 finals. What do we know about Slovakia?
Yeah, they're a team, obviously, we played them before, but it's quite some time ago. They're not something I'd be too fearful of, especially if we play in the manner in which we did the other night against Denmark. But March is such a long time away. I mean, you know, there could be a completely different complexion to the type of team that Mick McCarthy will have at his disposal. When you look at the under-21s last night and their performance, you'll have to think maybe Troy Parrott, who's already been in the senior squad, could be back up in contention for the place. Aaron Connolly as well. Slovakia will be at home, we think. That's the way the seeding should be. The draw on Friday will then decide if we were to beat Slovakia. It'll be either Bosnia or Northern Ireland in the final. There's a slight worry among some FAI sources that the FAI, UEFA rather, they have competition related reasons why they might change their mind, put it that way. To give a fair chance to all the hosts to qualify for the final tournament, the host teams may be allocated to different paths. So despite everything that they've said so far, there is a slight worry, a slight concern that, you know, they may change the situation. It may work in our favour.
Yeah.
We may end up actually playing at home if we were to make it to the final, but I think there's a determination among UEFA to try and get as many of the host cities who are hosting the tournament to have those countries involved in the competition as well.
And you mentioned the under-21s, a very happy Tala Stadium last night, and we should be delighted at the talent coming through.
They were brilliant, I have to say, especially second half. It's almost those, one of those classic game of two halves. Sweden took the lead against the run of play. Ireland knew they had work to do. So changes by Stephen Kenny at halftime, some enforced through injury, some tactical. And the second half, they went out. And it's a beautiful brand of football. And even though the personnel has changed, Ireland are playing, passing, moving, terrific fluency through the lines. Lee O'Connor, who played in the senior squad, scored a terrific goal. Parrott scored, as I said. Adam Ida, Zach Elbazedi, 4-1. They beat Sweden away 3-1. You know, I would hate to put too much pressure on very young shoulders. As Stephen himself was saying, Stephen Kenny, there's, you know, some of the players still 17 or 18 years of age, but they certainly look to be well-drilled, well-organised. Stephen Kenny giving great credit to the emerging talent programmes around the country and the fact that we do seem to have a new young breed of very good footballers, and long may that production line continue.
Yeah, and we all say all of us. Tony O'Donoghue, thank you for joining us. There's racing today at Dundalk. The first is off at 2:25, and for updates during the day, check out RTE News Now app and rte.ie. Rachel.
Well, as we reported earlier, Fine Gael says it won't be deselecting its Wexford by-election candidate Verona Murphy. This follows a series of controversies in which she said, among other things, that some asylum seekers needed to be deprogrammed and that children as young as three could have been manipulated by ISIS. The Fianna Fáil candidate in the Fingal by-election, Lorraine Clifford Lee, was also forced to apologise over a number of old tweets in which she made insulting remarks about travellers. And the Galway West TD Noel Grealish caused a row when he questioned the money being sent home by Nigerian immigrants. He had earlier referred to African asylum seekers as spongers. So is Irish politics changing? Professor David Farrell is the head of the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Good morning.
Good morning.
I remember about 20 years ago, there was a furore over comments made by the then Fianna Fáil TD, Ivor Callaly, about asylum seekers. But by and large, mainstream politicians in this country haven't tended to go there. Is that changing?
Well, that's the worry, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, we've been very fortunate in this country that we've dodged this extreme right populist bullet for quite a long while. We've seen it happening in other countries, and so far it hasn't happened here, and now that's the worry.
And that was despite a savage recession. When something similar happened in other countries, that's when the politics started to change.
That's right. It started to change dramatically in other countries around then, and it hasn't happened here up to now. And so the concern is, in a sense, we know it's always had the potential. Racism is rife here like anywhere else. We're no different from any other country in that regard. But so far, our political leaderships, I think, have played a pretty virtuous game in trying to, you know, dampen this down. The problem now is it's beginning to break through.
Verona Murphy said that she was reflecting what people were saying to her on the doorsteps, and especially on social media, people will complain that they can't raise any concerns about the impact of immigration without being accused of racism.
Well, unfortunately, you know, this is something that one has to tread very cautiously on. It's time for the politicians now to take some more proactive stance here to try and make sure that this sort of thing is nipped in the bud before it really starts to take off.
So what would you like to see the parties in particular doing?
I'd like to see a national conversation. You know, the fact that we know it's going to come here, unless we try and do something to try and stem its worst effects, why don't we take the battle to the extremists? Why don't we try to be preemptive here? Let's start a national conversation. And I would have thought there's at least two aspects to this. One is, let's have a forum of the party leaders. We've had that sort of thing in the past when discussing Northern Ireland. Let's discuss 21st century Ireland, a diverse republic, and have the party leaders come up with some sort of a set of standards that they will adhere to, and that if anyone in their ranks breaks those standards, they're out without any exception whatsoever. And secondly, let's have a citizens' assembly. We do that very well in this country. There's a lot of attention given to Ireland about what we've been doing here. Let's have a citizens' assembly to discuss our diverse republic.
There is mixed evidence, too, as to whether raising such issues actually makes any difference as to whether there are votes in it. I mean, candidates who've run on specific anti-immigration platforms in the past, say like Éanan O'Connell, haven't done particularly well.
That's right. There's a wonderful piece in today's Irish Independent by Teresa Reedy on this very topic. And she makes that point that, you know, while we know from the Irish National Election Study in 2016 that about a fifth of voters are expressing racist views, four-fifths aren't. So it isn't necessarily a winning strategy for candidates so far. The problem is we know in other countries that as this begins to leak through, as more mainstream politicians get bought into this agenda, as the media then respond and in some aspects of the media also get bought into this agenda, that can stoke up further racist attitudes. And then you'll see candidates emerging who'll break through.
Mm-hmm. I suppose travellers would also say that look at Peter Casey's performance in the last presidential election, that it would seem there's strong evidence that his vote was boosted when he started making derogatory comments about travellers.
And you know, the thing not to forget here as well is that our politics are very candidate-centred. Our elections are very candidate-centred. So voters look at candidates and candidates know that, so they have to find ways of distinguishing themselves. This is a strategy that some may find, you know, to their benefit, unfortunately.
Do you think that there's an appetite among the parties to address this issue and to maybe do something like you were suggesting there?
Well, I think in fairness now to the leaders of the two big mainstream parties, they've been somewhat caught on the hop right in the middle of a by-election. This is not the easiest time to try and take a dramatic strategy. So one has to give them something of the benefit of the doubt now. But once this by-election is over and in time for the next general election, which I know is not that far away, but things can move quickly if you want to, why not get those party leaders to come together with the other party leaders and get involved in this national conversation?
David Farrell of UCD, thanks for joining us on Morning Ireland.
Over the next week, we'll be visiting the constituencies to assess the mood of voters and hear about the issues that could determine how they'll vote on November the 29th. Today we start in Cork North Central, the by-election happening there to fill the seat left vacant by the election of Fianna Fáil's Billy Kelleher to the European Parliament. Cian McCormack sent us this report from Cork.
We're in right in the centre of Blackpool.
Glen Rover's yellow, green and black bunting crisscrosses the junction where Watercourse Road meets Thomas Davis Street.
We're opposite the church. It was a vibrant part of Blackpool at one time.
Patricia Donovan is leaving the Church of the Annunciation.
And we're opposite a little centre shop where Tomás McCurtain lived.
This is the centre of Blackpool in Cork North Central.
Thomas Davis Street is in a bad way.
Down the road outside a convenience store, Paul O'Leary is smoking a rollie.
A lot of people are really disheartened by politics at the moment, like, you know.
He's long-term unemployed and is disillusioned with politics.
I'm unemployed, to be honest.
And how long have you been out of work?
2009. She's saying I've done a couple of courses, that's it.
But he'll still vote in the by-election.
So what are the big issues?
Particularly housing, anyway, the homeless and the housing. I know people that families that are staying in hotels, and I know people that are on the streets as well, you know. It's a chronic state at the moment, like, you know.
Perched overlooking Blackpool on Assumption Road are the offices of the Echo and Examiner newspapers. Political reporter Sarah O'Dwyer is covering the by-election for the Echo. What she's heard on the canvas trail mirrors what people are saying.
There are different issues in different areas. There is the Dunkettle Interchange project, there is the Northern Ring Road project, there is the M20 project, and then alongside those, there is the need for a new hospital on the north side in particular. I think a lot of people are coming back to the health service, the homelessness and housing.
These opinions are no surprise to Dr. Dermot Kavanagh, director of Cork's Simon Community.
I suppose it's not a surprise. We have a very significant housing crisis in Cork, as in the rest of the country. We have seen a very big increase in the number of people becoming homeless. And in the last year alone, there's been a 23% increase in the number of homeless adults in Cork.
Back in Blackpool, Thomas Davis Street is run down. Election posters overlook its derelict buildings, and it leads to the newer, vibrant shopping area, which is very busy. It's here where another issue that will be repeated over and over again on my journey through other parts of this constituency is first mentioned: antisocial behaviour. Maria Walsh lives in the area.
it's definitely the antisocial behaviour around here, especially for the young children, where young children can't even go to a playground for fear that they're going to be jumped or targeted is not great. Like, I grew up here, I had a very happy childhood, and I fear for my 13-year-old child who does hang around here.
Cork North Central is a diverse constituency, not just in terms of geography, but also in terms of its demographic makeup. Again, The Echo's political reporter Sarah O'Dwyer explains.
It stretches from the north inner city, from areas such as Blackpool, Farnree, Mayfield, Ballyvillan and Gurnabrohar, to suburbs like Glanmire and Blarney, but it also then stretches out to rural areas such as the outskirts of Mallow. A lot of the people in the north inner city will be quite working class. There are some middle class areas such as Montanati. There are also then suburban areas like Glanmire and Blarney, which would also be commuter towns for Cork City.
In Glanmire, housing and health are mentioned in conversations, but so too are concerns over growing population and infrastructure.
My name is Brian Fahey, I'm from Glanmire in Cork. Well, the main issue is like homelessness, but I suppose specific to Glanmire, and there's a lot of construction going on at the moment, which addresses the issue, I suppose, the 600 new houses going in. But I suppose we need infrastructure to support that. We need the roads to be widened. Personally, I think a big thing is the Cork Limerick motorway, and it's crucial to link the airport to a lot of the multinationals in Cork.
My name's Anne-Marie Galvin. I'm from Glanmire, our health system. Unfortunately, my father passed away 7 weeks ago.
I'm very sorry.
Thank you. He was very, very ill, and he was in a ward with three other people an hour before he passed away, after a lot of tormenting people to try and get us a room, a private room. We got one an hour before he passed away. Yeah, it was horrific. It was awful. That's the way we said goodbye to our dad, you know. It was terrible.
Turn right onto Ballynaroon. Then you will arrive at your destination.
A series of winding countryside roads lead to Clontarf. This is the more rural part of the constituency. It's where Liam O'Leary from Blarney, also in Cork North Central, has stopped to collect some messages at Fitzpatrick's food store.
One of my biggest issues in Cork at the moment is juvenile crime. There are guys selling drugs.
How do you know that?
I've seen them.
What have you seen?
I've seen guys injecting themselves during the day. I've seen people selling drugs in Cork City during the day. Openly. That's happening.
But again, just as in Glanmire, there are concerns about expanding population. Local man Terence Fleming explains.
Well, the big issue is the large-scale development of housing in Clontarf. However, the infrastructure in Clontarf is very sparse. When people are brought in, there should be facilities there for them.
The mood in Cork North Central is mixed, reflecting the diverse makeup of its constituents. And while issues are local, they hit at the heart of what matters to voters and how they live.
I think issues of social security are at the core of this by-election. Certainly housing and probably healthcare, I'd say, are the two core issues affecting people. People need security in their lives. They need to know that they have a place where they can call home. And people need to know as well that if they become unwell, they'll be looked after. So I think that's why these are core issues in the election.
That report from Cork North Central by Cian McCormack. It's a minute and a half to nine.